My name is Fred Wilson. I'll be the hearings officer for today's public hearing. This is the time set aside for the public hearing for the Trotner Farms modification case. The file number is Z0174-20-MOD. Before I launch into my normal hearings officer spiel, Mr. Hamburg is going to give a little explanation of how this will work for everybody on Zoom. I think you're on mute, Glenn, Mr. Hamburg.
Thank you. Clackamas County is abiding by social distancing requirements during the coronavirus pandemic. So this public hearing will be conducted virtually using the Zoom platform. Panelists for today's hearing, which include the hearings officer, county staff, and the applicant, as well as their representative, have both audio and video capability. Audience members who have joined the meeting will have their mics muted unless they wish to testify, in which case they will be called upon to do so by the county staff moderator, that's Darcy. Audience members' video will not be turned on at this time, though. Today's hearing is being recorded as required by law. The county will make every effort to post the recording on the county website later today. There is a designated time during the hearing when it will be open for testimony. The hearings officer will make it clear when this is. If you want to provide testimony, you will utilize the raise hand feature. Attendees on PC or iPad, you have a raise hand button on the Zoom bar. It's at the top or bottom, depending on the device. When the moderator switches you over to provide testimony, your screen will look different for a little while, so just keep that in mind. Primarily, you will see all participants' cameras, not just the one who is speaking. Staff will call upon you when it is time for you to provide testimony. Be sure to provide your name and mailing address when you begin. Once you have provided your testimony, your mic will be muted and your screen will be returned to normal. If you prefer not to testify during the hearing or you have additional testimony to add, The record will be left open to all parties to submit written testimony for a minimum of 7 days following the hearing. This will be followed by an additional period for response to new testimony and, unless waived, a final period for the applicant to submit their final legal argument. You can email written testimony to me, which is ghamburg, G-H-A-M-B-U-R-G, at clackamas.us. Or mail it to the Clackamas County Planning and Zoning Division at 150 Beaver Creek Road, Oregon City, Oregon, 97045. The staff contact email address, my email address, is also available on the web page where you found the Zoom link for today's hearing. Testimony must be received by 4 p.m. on the day the record closes. People who testify and provide their mailing address will receive a copy of the hearings officer's written decision. If you do not wish to testify but would like to receive the decision, you must provide your email or standard mailing address, either by email to me or by entering it in the Zoom chat function during the hearing. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hamburg. As you're all aware, this is the opportunity to give testimony, evidence, and legal argument. I won't make a decision today. It'll be a later written decision that comes out after the record's been closed. Since you are all veterans of this, I'll give my abbreviated spiel, but I need to disclose whether I've had any ex-party contacts. I haven't. All I know is what I've gotten from the planning department that's in the decision that's being appealed. I have to disclose that I'm biased. I'm not. I mean, obviously we had this case before, but I don't have any reason to feel one way or the other about it now. Finally, I need to disclose that I have any conflicts of interest. I don't. As you know, the way this will work, we'll start with the staff report from Mr. Hamburg. After that, the applicant will have an opportunity to present their case. If anybody else wants to testify in favor, they'll have a chance. If anybody appears, I don't think we have anybody now, but if somebody shows up and wants to testify against, they'll have an opportunity. Mr. Hamburg will have a chance to respond, or Ms. Dance if she has anything to add. And then finally, the applicant will have a chance for final rebuttal. Make sure that if you testify, we all know you, but give us your name and address so that shows up on the record. Please direct your testimony to the approval criteria. It's just section 1309, so it's pretty limited today. Make sure you raise any and all the issues you have. If you don't raise those issues, you may be precluded from raising them in the future if there are any further proceedings or appeals of this case. I think with that, we can probably turn to the staff report.
Thank you. I'm going to go ahead and share a screen again. Great. I hope everybody can see my first slide of the PowerPoint. Okay. Very good. Good morning, everybody. As I noted, my name is Glenn Hamburg. I'm a planner with Clackamas County's Planning and Zoning Division. Today is an appeal hearing on a decision for case file number Z0174-20-MOD. The subject property is this property listed on your screen at 10766 Southeast 362nd Avenue in Boring. It's two separate tax lots, but just one legal lot of record zoned exclusive farm use. The proposal in the application, which I'll explain, is a modification, changes to a vested right determination that was made in a separate file, which is Z0159-19VR. The applicant for this modification is Troutner Farms, LLC. The appellant is their representative, Mr. Tim Ramos. Actually, even before I start, I just wanted to acknowledge everybody's patience for this type of application. It's a sort of a strange one. We've never had a modification of a vested right determination before. Usually when we get modifications, it's to a specific development proposal. Maybe somebody got a conditional use permit for a certain use, and now they want to maybe change the shape of the building or the parking area, something kind of literal like that. So this is a bit of a strange one to do a modification to a vested right determination. Nonetheless, there are established approval criteria for us to consider, and we can make a modification decision on any type 2 land use application, including a vested right determination. So I'm going to do a little recap of just how we got here, but there's plenty of information in the record as well, and I don't want to be repetitive. The issue came before the hearings officer back in December of 2019 of whether or not the applicant, the same applicant, had a vested right to more than one licensed premises on a lot that is zoned exclusive farm use. And the issue here was about a law that had taken effect after the applicant had gotten land use approvals for marijuana production. That law in ZDO 271 was enacted prior to the vested right determination, and it restricted any lot of record in the exclusive farm use district to just one licensed grower, effectively, per lot of record, as I say. Technically, it's about licensed premises, but what we mean is the number of licenses, essentially the number of licensed growers that can operate from a single property. To be clear, ZDO 271 did not make any other change that was taken up in the former vested right determination case. The vested right determination case was only about this license restriction. And you can refer back to the record in that case for an explanation of that. So prior to the adoption of ZDO 271, there was no limit on the number of licensed growers that could operate from a tract. After ZDO 271, there was a restriction that said only one licensed grower. However, the applicant made a vested right application to show that they essentially had always intended to have multiple licensed growers there, and that they had met common law factors to show that they had made significant progress to the establishment of those multiple licenses, and they had the right to continue towards establishing those multiple licenses despite the law change. And so we looked at, well, when was ZDO 271 originally noticed, and what sort of expenses had the applicant already put forth by then, despite that prospective law change. And the hearings officer found that they indeed had a vested right to more than one licensed premises. So again, ZDO 271 was about license limits. It didn't change the number of buildings that you could have on the property. It didn't change the size of any grow that could be allowed. Indeed, those factors have never been regulated in the exclusive farm use district. Ever since recreational marijuana production has been allowed in the exclusive farm use district, it's always been the case that you can have any number of buildings of any dimensions, of any size, dedicated to marijuana production. The only thing that changed was just the license limit. That was the issue. So the Holmes analysis that we did was based on that law change, not about any other law change. And no other issue of vesting was considered. We didn't consider whether the applicant had the right to, had a vested right to do anything else other than have multiple licensed premises on the subject property. I think it's helpful that we parse what the difference between a vested right and a non-conforming use is, because sometimes those terms are out there. And it is important to know that they're not the same thing. The previous land use decision that is being modified here was not about non-conforming uses. It was about a vested right. So non-conforming uses, which are defined in our code, the county has a term of what we mean by it. It refers to uses that are already established. So it's an established use that was lawful when it was established, but there has been a change in laws to say that that particular use is no longer allowed. A lawfully established non-conforming use can continue as it is established, notwithstanding the law change. A vested right is not a non-conforming use, though. It's similar, but it's not the same. A vested right is as the Court of Appeals found in the Fountain Village v. Multnomah County in 2001, is essentially an inchoate non-conforming use. Not a non-conforming use yet, but it's getting there. It's essentially a right to continue towards establishing a non-conforming use in the future. So Z0159-19VR was not a non-conforming use decision. We have in the code specific criteria that must be looked at in order to determine whether there is a non-conforming use. There's what's called a non-conforming use verification process. It requires an application, an evaluation of approval criteria, public noticing. None of that was done. The previous decision from 2019 made no determination on any sort of non-conforming use. It also didn't approve any alterations to any non-conforming use. As the decision itself says, the only issue here is whether the applicant has satisfied the common law factors for a vested right. So there is no verified non-conforming use indeed for the property at all. The county has never evaluated according to the approval criteria whether there is a lawful non-conforming use on the property. In the future, the property owner might find it useful to go through the process of making an application for a non-conforming use verification. They indeed might also want to alter any non-conforming use that they have, but no such non-conforming use decision has yet been made. The criteria for non-conforming uses for their verification and also for their alteration are in Section 1206 of the county's Zoning and Development Ordinance. This idea of a business park in the EFU district is an important thing to talk about as well. Other zones allow certain uses that are these kind of group activities. They're sort of specifically defined in the code. For example, manufactured dwelling parks. That's what we call them in Clackamas County, essentially a mobile home park. That's an identified use in specific zones. You can't have a manufactured dwelling park just anywhere. You could only have a manufactured dwelling park as we define it in certain zones. A business park has never been an allowed land use in the EFU district. We don't have a definition for it. It's never been specified as an allowed use.
I don't think we should.
Or otherwise.
I mean, business park isn't, I mean, this wasn't approving some brand new type of use that expanded the kind of uses. I mean, what got the vested right is for a farm use. I think, but we just call it a business park just sort of to describe the applicant's, their business plan. I don't understand that to like, oh, you get this brand new use that's not allowed in farm zones. That's just how we describe their business model. I mean, we call it an agricultural park or whatever. It was just sort of a shorthand way of describing what they're doing.
Agreed. Yeah. And I think that it was an effective way to sort of describe this instance of having multiple licensed premises on the property. But to make the distinction between something that is a specifically defined land use, like a manufactured dwelling park, which is versus something like this business park, which is sort of just a rhetorical device rather than a specifically defined land use. Exactly. The allowable land uses in the EFU district are only those listed in Table 401-1. And that has not changed since they made that application back for the vested right back in 2019 and between when they had made this modification decision. Also, just to reiterate the difference between licensed premises and buildings. So again, the zoning development ordinance has never had restrictions on the number, size, or order of construction of buildings associated with marijuana production, ever since marijuana production has been allowed. So that wasn't the subject of the vested right determination. It was just the licensed premises. There's no changes that have been made in the criteria for building construction. So that since the applicant first got approval for marijuana production to when they issued the vested right decision, there had been no change. Again, the decision was only about the number of licenses. That was the only issue that changed. So Z0159-19VR was the vested right determination. It's very clear that the vested right determination, that the decision found a vested right to work towards establishing up to 60 licenses on one EFU tract, despite the law change. And it specifically explained that it's in those 60 buildings. And it seems clear from the decision that the applicant doesn't have to just have one licensed premises in one building. They could, if they want, have of their up to 60 licenses, multiple licensees in one building, or they could have one licensed premises include multiple building. So there wasn't this one-to-one connection, is what it seems to say in the decision. Other things in the decision that presumably did not include or could not have included are the following. As I explained, it wasn't a non-conforming use verification or alteration decision because no application for that was ever made. We didn't evaluate that approval criteria. It didn't provide a vested right to a land use that had never been allowed. That seems clear. It seems clear that it didn't amend the ZDO criteria for non-conforming use verifications or alterations. It seems clear it didn't provide any exemption from conditions of approval in other unappealed land use decisions. It doesn't seem to provide any interpretation of whether other decisions' conditions of approval have been met or not. And then it seems fairly clear that it doesn't provide for a tolling of the clock on other decisions' approval period. In fact, this was specifically addressed in the decision. It says, I do not see that issue as before me, and I do not address that issue here, is what the hearings officer said in that decision. This is a matter of other separate land use applications having a four-year approval period. And you might recall from the last appeal hearing, there was a request by the applicant to consider those approval periods in those separate land use decisions to be tolled. So that they could have more time to implement them, given the fact that they may have been stalled by other processes on the side. And the hearings officer felt that while that might be seen fair, he found that it wasn't before him and he didn't address it. So that seems fairly clear to staff that that wasn't at issue in the decision. There is this footnote in the decision that does seem to be at issue here. and staff, you know, want to be able to administer it and try to figure out what it means. And what we think it means is that it seems to offer an opinion on the usefulness of certain ZDO requirements for future non-conforming uses. But we have specific criteria, as I showed you, in the code for when a vested right, or I'm sorry, a non-conforming use verification application is needed, when an alteration application is needed, and what the criteria are. Those are in the code. It also seems to clarify, as I said, that one building can have multiple licensed premises, or multiple premises, or one premises could include multiple buildings. It seems to help clarify that because during the appeal hearing back last year, this came up of whether or not they would be necessarily restricted to just a one-to-one thing. It seems to help explain that, no, they wouldn't be. It also seems to help define the project for the purposes of conducting the vesting analysis. You know, those home factors require us to look at the total cost of the project. Well, in order to do that, we have to define what the project is. So staff reads footnote 6 as providing some definition of what the project is for the purposes of the vesting analysis. Note that that decision was never appealed by the applicant or any other party. It wasn't appealed for lack of clarity, and it wasn't appealed to change its determination. For example, its decision that it wouldn't take up the tolling the clock matter, for example. That aspect was never appealed. And since that decision, it's been faithfully administered by the county. I can report that since January, the county has approved building permits, electrical permits, plumbing permits for this development. The county has even swapped out luxes, essentially licenses for different growers, without even requiring a non-conforming use alteration application. So for example, if one of the tenants of one of these buildings applied to the county for certification to use that building for marijuana production for their state licensing, and then another tenant were, if they were to move and another tenant come in, we simply just sign that form for the other tenant to be doing that same thing in that same building. We've already done that. So now we have this modification request. Now the applicant is requesting a change to the hearings officer's decision. There are multiple changes. They're identified in attachment A. Attachment A as changed by the applicant after they first submitted it. So the original request is in exhibit 2, but then they changed that request subsequently. And what we've evaluated in this decision is that one, the one that they changed it to, that's exhibit 3. And it includes the attachment A that the applicant would like added to the hearings officer's decision. We could parse it in many different ways, but it seems to have essentially 14 different changes. And those are outlined each in the staff report. I won't go through each one individually unless you like me to, but here they are in summary. And they are substantive changes. They're not all about just providing clarification. Indeed, some of them are a request to have the complete reverse of what the hearings officer provided in that decision. So for one, they asked that it now find a vested right to a different land use, something called a unitary business park. In the original application that we looked at, there wasn't any definition provided of what the applicant meant by a unitary business park, but we got just at the end of the day yesterday some information about what they believe a unitary business park to be. And I'll enter that into the record as Exhibit 11.
Okay, yes, I haven't seen that.
Yeah, so it just came in yesterday, and I'll make sure in any other exhibits that might get into the record today sent to the hearings officer. The application also now requests that the decision verify one or more non-conforming uses and preemptively approve any future alterations. They ask essentially that they be exempted from future non-conforming use requirements from the code. They ask that they be exempted from exempt future non-conforming uses if they were to establish them, including those that may be related to buildings or structures from the doctrine of partial discontinuance. So they talk about, for example, non-conforming development. I don't know what that means. I don't know what non-conforming development is, but presumably if this the county were to suddenly change the laws related to buildings, it seems to be that they're asking that they might be exempted from having to show that they have a non-conforming use to their specific buildings and don't need to go through an alteration process for them. They ask that the vested right determination go beyond licenses to now also address buildings, including their construction timing. They ask that the decision extend the approval period on other land use decisions, despite that earlier decision rejecting that request. So they're asking the hearings officer to change that to say, no, now those previous land use decisions, the clock is tolled. They ask for an interpretation and a change to the conditions of approval of those other land use decisions. And they ask that it have a set special applicant-specific requirement for building occupancy, existing county rules notwithstanding. So they want the decision to say what the conditions for getting building occupancy are now. So we looked at all of these different requests, again, about 14 of them. And we thought through the approval criteria for a modification in section 1309. A lot of the criteria in section 1309 isn't relevant to this application because they're about dimensional standards and physical development, which this application doesn't propose. What are relevant are the first two subsections, A and B. Subsection A says that the request must be consistent with the prior approval, and that subsection B says it must be consistent with all ordinance provisions that were in effect at the time when they turned the modification request in. These are really the only two criteria that we have to look at in this particular case. Consistent with the prior approval and consistency with all ordinance provisions on the books. I'm going to say today because what is on the books today is the same as what was on the books when they turned in their application. So the prior decision was a vested right determination. The criteria for that today, as it was back in 2019, is just the one provision in subsection 1206.09. And that subsection says, well, you got to go through a type 2 land use application, et cetera, et cetera. But it will be evaluated, quote, whether or not it's vested under common law. That's the standard that we have to look at according to the code, is whether or not the request was, quote, vested under common law. So the modification criteria require us to consider whether or not each of the proposed modifications were both consistent with the prior approval and vested under common law. So the applicant doesn't take each of their 14 proposed changes to the hearings officer's decision and show how they are consistent with the prior approval and also vested under common law. But staff have endeavored to kind of break that out as we can in the staff report. And maybe I'm just going to refer the hearings officer to the staff report for that analysis. But I'll say in general that the decision was a denial because we could not find that those 14 requests meet those two criteria based on what has been submitted into the record by then. So for example, issuing a decision on a non-conforming use verification would not, under staff's view, be consistent with a vested right approval. We couldn't see how changing the decision to now make a determination on whether or not something was a lawful non-conforming use would be consistent with the prior application. We don't know whether or not changing the decision to find a vested right to something the applicant now calls a unitary business park would be consistent with that prior decision or not either, given that that prior decision was about multiple licensed premises on a property. Changing the hearings officer's decision to now toll the clock on other land use decisions would seem inconsistent with a prior decision that's explicitly said that they would not do so. Finally, the requested changes, including the proposed exemptions from future non-conforming use requirements, they don't explain how providing that was vested under common law. So in summary, the staff have not been able to find that each of their specifically requested changes would meet those Section 1309 criteria. Now, we did get this letter just yesterday that kind of touches on some of these issues. I have not digested it completely, so I don't have a whole lot to say about it. But here's what I can say just generally. From what I see, yesterday's letter still does not identify how each requested change meets the approval criteria. It does often err an opinion on what the applicant believes the intent of some of the modification criteria are and what they believe are the important criteria to be thought about in their proposal. It does, as I mentioned before, now include an explanation of a land use they propose to be termed a unitary business park. The applicant does seem to acknowledge that there is a difference between a vested right and a non-conforming use in that letter. But then there's multiple references to the non-conforming use. And so staff just needs to know what that refers to, because there is no non-conforming use on the property. It makes references to, again, to, quote, non-conforming development, but that's unclear, as we don't have any verified non-conforming use. ZDO 271 was about licenses, not about the structures or anything else. So we're not aware of any buildings, the number of buildings, their size or their order of construction as violating any current law. We don't know if they are non-conforming, for example, to setbacks. Maybe they built a building within setbacks. In order for that to be lawfully non-conforming, they would need to go through a process to show how that building was lawfully established prior to the adoption of setback rules. But there's been no analysis of that. I don't believe that's the case. Staff assumes the only issue at hand is a future non-conforming use of multiple licensed premises on the property. But again, we've not gone through an application to show that there are indeed multiple licensed premises on the property, how many of them there are, and whether those licensed premises were lawfully established. The letter does say that staff has, quote, an unending requirement for new non-conforming use reviews. Just for the record, staff has no expectation or requirement for non-conforming uses other than what is spelled out in the ZDO. So the ZDO tells us, it defines what a non-conforming use is under the county's rules when they're required to go through that land use application for it. And we would apply that standard to any land use. So that's a lot. I assume that there are going to be questions, but that's the end of my presentation. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hamburg. Before I launch into specific questions, I sort of feel like I'm not getting the whole picture here. Like what's really going on? Because I'll ask Mr. Ramos too. Maybe he'll have an explanation for why we're doing this. It seems that the applicant's thinking that like unnecessary roadblocks have been thrown up since the original decision. And then the county saying, no, we haven't. So I'm kind of confused what the big fight's about. Kind of going through the things, the way I see this is the only law that was holding them up from doing what they wanted to do was only allowing to have one grower on the property. And so getting the vested right determination, all that said was that provision doesn't apply anymore. You basically go back and you can do exactly what you could have done before that law came into effect, except you can't go above 60. So I'm not sure what all the confusion is about. The footnote 6 is, if you recall from the first case, Mr. Ramos was concerned that I think we might have used the example of like a shopping mall or a shopping center, and you have you had McDonald's there, and McDonald's leaves and Burger King comes in. Oh, is that an alteration of the non-conforming use? And I was just saying, my understanding, no, it's not. That you wouldn't have to go through a non-conforming use for that. I'm not sure whether, that's how that would strike me. If it came back to me, I'd be like, no, that's not an alteration. But I can't bind, there's a different hearings officer or LUBA or Court of Appeals. I can't tell them what they have to do. But that was just sort of my way of saying, that's how I see this working. That basically the growers are fungible. It doesn't matter which grower it is. And I think that's how the county understands it too. If you look at Mrs. Hughes' letter, I think that's exactly what she said. And I think I pretty much agree with everything she said in her letter. So I'm wondering why there's argument about that. And we talked about how I wasn't really approving a brand new kind of use, like a business park. So it's just describing their farm use. And then getting to the tolling of the clock. I can certainly understand why they'd want to do that. But sort of what I talked about before is like, I don't think that's the vested right determination or modification of it. I don't think that's where you address that. So Mr. Hamburg, putting aside the whole vested right determination, say somebody has something like that with a 4-year thing, and there's a question about whether or not they're going to do it or whether they've achieved it. How would that play out? Would that be like a neighbor complaints and say, hey, they didn't do it within 4 years, take their permit away. If there's a dispute, they say, instead of this vested right, say there was another appeal of a like related case that hung it up, and they say, hey, we get told because of that, would they file an application or like a modification of that first approval? How would that work under the county's procedures?
How would they toll the clock on those the approval period for those other land use applications?
Right. Yeah, I guess that's for this case. So you like the decision here says the vested rights case or a modification of it, that's not how you determine or not whether those things are told. I think the county might have the position that they're not, but if Mr. Ramos wants to find out whether they are told or not, how does he do that?
So I don't know the answer to that that question, because those previous other land use decisions are type 1 decisions, and the modification rules don't allow any modification to a type 1 decision. So I know that you couldn't use the modification process to change anything that those type 1 land use decisions say, but what those land use decisions say and what they mean, I suppose there's some legal process outside of just the standard land use permit application process where that would be evaluated. I just don't know.
It'd be clear if somebody had appealed those type 1 decisions, say, whatever that process would be, that then they would be told. Mm-hmm. Those specific decisions weren't appealed, so it's not, slam dunk, clear cut that they're told. But Mr. Amos's position is they ought to be, and he has legal reasoning for it. So there needs to be some way for him to get a ruling on that. So how does he do that if it's not in this case?
I don't know the answer to that right now. Practically speaking, though. To echo your statement of just wondering, what the utility of some of these modification requests are, is we're approving, despite any concerns about the validity of the 4-year approval period in those separate land use applications, we have been since January approving building permits, plumbing permits, electrical, et cetera. So we're treating it as still allowable land use decision. And we have told the applicant that what they need to do to maintain their vested right status is just show progress towards establishing at some point in their future their prospective non-conforming use. So that might be showing that they are actively trying to get building permits, that they are actively applying for licenses, that they're doing work towards establishing up to 60 licensed premises on the subject property. We've told the applicant that as long as they keep up those efforts at whatever scale they might be, it might be the case that their vested right approval remains valid. they might continue work on this project for years. They might each year be doing progress on certain buildings. And we would continue to honor that. What would happen, and as the planning director outlined in that email that you referenced, is that once they stop making active progress towards establishing their non-conforming use for a period of 12 months or more, then the vested right authority would stop. So, and whatever they have on the property at that time could become lawfully non-conforming. They would need to make an application to show what they have and show that it was established lawfully. But as long as the applicant is making progress towards establishing a non-conforming use, multiple licensed premises on one track, then they could keep up that work. And we've articulated that to the applicant.
Okay. All right, thank you. Maybe I'll see what Mr. Amos has to say. We'll have some more questions for you when it gets back to you. So thank you, Mr. Amber. Ms. Dance, was there anything you wanted to provide right now, or are you just more here for support in case something comes up?
I'm just more here for support. Just to kind of understand what's going on, because I do most of the permitting and groundwork.
The cannabis expert, so.
Liz is helpful to have here too. If she's the one that actually will look at applications for building permits for any sort of physical work, and she would be the person that signs off on septic approvals for planning, for example. So she's up to speed on what the county has done for the applicant since the previous determination was made.
Okay, thanks. All right, Mr. Ramis, now's your opportunity.
All right, thank you very much. For your record, Tim Ramis from the Jordan Ramis Law Firm here today on behalf of the applicant in the case. In terms of introduction, perhaps the most helpful thing that I could do would be to cover a couple of topics. One is your question about how we come to be here today. And then second, my understanding of what is before the hearings officer and what is not, to try to at least frame the issues. We're here basically because a project of this size is a very scary undertaking if you're not certain of the regulatory requirements and the regulatory environment. And so following the decision that you made, we sought from the county additional guidance as to what the issues might be in the future. And we had hoped that by informal means, we could develop some sort of a written understanding or a guidepost or some sort of resolution of some of the issues that we thought might be out there, such as the one you posed. We were not successful at that. I think the county staff was not that comfortable with putting in a written form answers to the questions that we had. And our client became nervous, I think, about his understanding of some of the statements that were being made in the course of the conversation about what might be problems in the future, and how those positions squared against the footnote that you cited. You know, the footnote basically says this is one operation. It's not 60 separate buildings and separate licenses, and that it would be operated in that way, and that's perfectly permissible, and that the footnote also says it would not be necessary in the future to approach the county for further non-conforming use approvals. But I think it's fair to say that in the conversations we had with the county, what we at least believe we heard was things like this. You may have a vested rights determination, but in the future, you'll need a separate application for non-conforming uses. You may have a vested rights determination to build and operate, but it's subject to our staff-level determination about whether you met certain timing requirements or whether your implementation was adequate. You may have a vested right to run this as one business, but if one of those buildings is vacant for a year, you may run into a problem being able to re-tenant it. because it may be treated as abandoned. There are others, and you can see those theories in the 14 various explanations that Glenn has given, Mr. Hamburg has given in his denial report. Those left us in a situation where we were quite nervous about what was going to happen in the future and whether this major investment might end up being the subject of future litigation over abandonment and that sort of thing. So our determination was that when the request from our client was to seek some further clarification through the modification process of that footnote and what it actually meant and how it might be implemented. So that's really the sort of the genesis of this application, trying to understand what is in the future in terms of the regulatory environment. We think that some of the arguments made in the denial are troubling. They seem to repudiate parts of the hearings officer's decision. They raise questions about whether the hearings officer exceeded its jurisdiction in making a decision. There are arguments that the document, the decision document, is ambiguous and therefore doesn't provide answers to some of these questions. And because of that, we thought it legitimate to come back and ask for further clarification so that to the extent that the staff feels that it's not clear, that we would have answers to that. And so what we believe is before you is not a retrial of the original case. It is not a reconsideration of whether the hearings officer had authority or didn't have authority to write the footnote. It's not a reconsideration of your actual determinations. It is, we think, clarification of what those things mean so that we can try and advance this cause of trying to be certain about what the environment is. You raised the question, how would the applicant find out about a particular question? And Mr. Hamburg's question was, well, I don't know. And so we're left with trying to invent a process to do that. So that's essentially why we're here.
So just for on that footnote, what I was getting at was that, what I just said, the growers are fungible. I wasn't getting into whether or not, you know, it could be discontinued for like 12 months of inactivity. I think you submitted the Deer Point case, the Columbia County case, which is a pretty good argument that, you know, as long as they're trying to put somebody back in, you don't lose it. But, and what I was getting is like, it'd be speculation for me to decide in the vested rights case how some future dispute would shake out. I think all I can say is, at least the way I see it, they're fungible. Changing tenants doesn't require a new non-conforming use or an alteration to the non-conforming use. It's the same vested right that eventually becomes a non-conforming use. And I think the county agrees with that part, don't you think, from Ms. Chi's letter?
I'm not certain of that, and that's why we're here. But those sorts of questions are the things we anticipate in the future. We put this case before you because only you can make the judgment about what your intent was and to the extent to which our modifications are consistent. I mean, that is the fundamental criteria. Are the things we suggest consistent with your decision previously? If they were not, then they should be rejected. If they were, then they should be on.
I just worry that a lot of them seem to be, and I completely understand why you'd want to answer those questions, but a lot of them seem sort of speculative, like how would a future dispute shake out? And that would, I think that would depend on the terms of the future dispute, like especially, you know, say, you know, you do have, it takes you more than a year to get some of the growers back in, but you were doing everything you possibly could to get new tenants in, and it didn't happen. I mean, it seems like that's a legal issue. You know, you'd have to look at the case law. I don't think I can modify that the first decision talked about that, or I could somehow modify it to say how that would shake out. It seems it would just have to shake out the way law of non-conforming uses work.
I would agree with you. I don't think it would be fair for us to ask you to rule on the outcome of a future case that hasn't come up yet. But I think it is fair for us to ask what the rules would be and to present an argument that here is a way to approach the problem. Here are the rules that do apply. And those rules are consistent with your original decision. And that's how we understand what we're asking for.
Okay.
Our view of what is before you and what is not is that what is not before you is a retrial of the case, not before you the decisions about future fact situations that haven't arisen yet. That we don't think is germane to this case, and allegations about whether you had authority or did not, or exceeded authority, or whether you did or did not understand the code, I don't think are germane. The test is whether or not what we're proposing is consistent with the decision that was made. The concern, I guess, when you say what you asked, kind of what's underlying this, the concern is that we may be facing a situation where the staff is essentially picking and choosing from parts of your decision and choosing to implement parts of it and not others. And we are concerned about that because our understanding of the decision-making process is that it is unitary. There's one government, there's one decision, and that decision is to be followed. It's not a context in which the hearings officer makes a decision and then the staff decides whether or not that decision was consistent with the code or not. That's not the process, and we are concerned that implication is here.
How would that shake out? What do you mean? What would staff be doing that they shouldn't be doing?
Right. To the extent the staff says, you must come in for an additional nonconforming use review, that would be inconsistent with the precise language of your decision in the footnote that says we don't have to do that.
What would they be making you come in to get a nonconforming use for?
For nonconforming use status. Staff has argued that you have a vested right, but you don't have a nonconforming use. There's apparently the implication here that we might have to apply in the future for an additional recognition of nonconforming use status. At the same time, the staff is saying, we haven't made you do that yet. But they're holding out the possibility that they might.
Are you talking about sort of a grand nonconforming use that recognizes the sort of basically that you did what you wanted to do, the 60 and 60 basically, or are they saying you have to get other, like a whole bunch of different nonconforming uses for little individual parts of the project?
I think the latter. I think that is the concern, that we might at some point face the argument that we need to come in for individual approvals.
Is that correct, Mr. Hamburg, that they'd have to come in for a whole bunch of nonconforming use determinations?
I don't really know what the nonconforming use is that's being referred to here, but the presumption is we're talking about a prospective nonconforming use of multiple licensed premises on a tract zoned EFU. In the future, if they want the county to verify that nonconformance is legal, they make an application. If they want to add to or otherwise alter their nonconforming use, if and when they ever have one verified, then the code requires an alteration application to be made and an analysis to be done of whether that proposed alteration would have additional adverse impacts to the neighborhood.
Right. But just if they just getting what they, you know, there's, let's just call it their 60 and 60, that their original plan.
Yeah.
I'm not sure about this because I've never thought about this until now, but if somebody gets a vested right to complete something, and then, you know, they have a certain amount of time to complete it. I mean, most nonconforming uses case we get, somebody's been doing it without approval, and you go back and sort of retroactively, you know, authorize it. Say, yeah, you're allowed to do this. So do they, and that sort of establishes the parameter of the nonconforming use. Here, we're kind of going forward instead of back. Do you understand that normally, like every vested rights case, once they sort of achieve the right that was vested, once they sort of, you know, full production, do they have to come in again to get a nonconforming use verification based on this?
I followed the question. Thank you. No, you are not required to make an application for verification of a nonconforming use in order to lawfully continue it. You do have to make an application though, if you want to alter it.
Right. So yeah.
Planning director's email explains, imagine a circumstance where the applicant makes efforts to establish 40 licensed premises, stops all activities on the property, stops bothering trying to get licenses from the state, just everything, just, I don't know, moves to Mexico. Well, if a year goes by and they only have 40 licensed premises on the property, that's what they would be presumably have non-conforming. And if they ever wanted to add another licensed premises to that, 41, 42, even up to 60, then they would need to make a non-conforming use alteration application.
Right. I don't think it would be disputed that once the actual non-conforming use is locked in, you know, if they didn't get to 60, like you said, and then they, after the non-conforming use gets locked in, they want to expand, that would be an alteration. I'm not sure what the answer is, because I think the original decision gave them, what was it, 4 years to complete their vested rights? Is that correct? So I'm not, it's an interesting issue if they get 4 years, if they take 12 of them off, what that means. I'm not sure what the answer to that would be, but certainly if in 4 years they have the 60 and 60, or that they only get to 50 and 50, then if they want to expand, I don't even think Mr. Ramos would dispute that at that point they would probably have to get an alteration. So
yes, you want to expand. Right. Does Mr. Troutner have something to offer on this issue? I saw your hand up, and I
yes, if you guys don't mind, I just wanted to pipe in for one quick minute. The biggest, scariest issue for us out of the 14 that is pressing the most on our minds is that multiple times Jennifer Hughes has told me verbally and via email that in her opinion, if a building is licensed and it becomes unlicensed and it takes us longer than 12 months to get a new license in that building, that our vested rights will no longer be for 60 licenses. It will be for 59. And that happens again, it's 58. And that's what she implied. And that's what scares us the most, is that because OLCC takes 2 years sometimes to get a license issued and put into place, no matter how hard or fast we work to get that building relicensed, it's always going to take longer than 12 months, and that's outside of our control. And we just don't feel that it's we feel that it's outside of the scope of our vested rights for her to say that we're just going to, it won't be 60 anymore, it'll be a vested rights for 59 or 58 or 57. And we want to be protected, in that regard. That's all I have to say.
Yeah, I totally understand that concern. I'm afraid I don't think that I can do that in this modification. I think that's just going to be an issue of non-conforming use law. And then Mr. Ramos submitted that the Deer Point case, which I think makes a really good argument. Sounds good to me. I think, I totally agree with Lupa's decision there, that that as long as you're working towards your eventual goal, the fact that you might not have achieved it. That was a case where a mobile home park, and they lose a tenant, and I think it was because some sort of violations. They couldn't get anybody back in for during the year period. So their longtime opponent said, "Oh nope, you lost that. You have one less spot in your park now." And Lou was like, "No, they were doing everything they could," which I think was probably pretty equivalent to working with OLCC. So I mean, I think you'd have a great case, but I don't think that I can make that determination in this proceeding. And I realize that's not super helpful.
I certainly will address that further this morning, but I guess initially what I would say about that is that points up this question I'm raising about what rules will apply in discontinuance argument in light of the fact that the original determination, vested rights determination, says that this is an overall operation, that it is not 60 individual units. It is one operation. And in our view, when the staff in the denial talks about preserving the argument of partial discontinuance, that implies very directly that they think the right rule to apply is premised on individual, 60 individual buildings. In fact, if it's a unitary use, which I think is what you described the use as being, the correct rule to apply is the one that was applied in the Campbell case. And I can talk about that in more detail, but that's the ambiguity that creates real problems for the troutmakers. And in my view, the argument the staff is holding out for, the partial discontinuance rule, is completely inconsistent with the language of your footnote. And I'll explain that further. But that is troubling because it would imply that there's a decision by the hearings officer, but the staff is free to sort of interpret it away or nullify it. And I think that that is not the system that we have. I think it's instructive to look to the decision Luba made some years ago in the case of Multnomah County versus Multnomah County. Luba, in that case, had the opportunity to recognize that there are these multiple decision makers who can sort of veto each other's decisions, but it rejected that approach. In the Multnomah County case, a hearings officer rejected a staff recommendation and instead went with the applicant's request. The staff of Multnomah County filed a case at Luba challenging the hearings officer's decision. That's why it's called Multnomah County versus Multnomah County. And in that decision, Luba rejected this idea of multiple decision makers who can nullify each other's rulings by saying that it's really a unitary approach, that standing couldn't be established if you couldn't show adversity, and the county couldn't be adverse to itself, and that being aggrieved couldn't be shown because the county can't be aggrieved by itself. There was only one decision. So that's why we think it's consistent with your decision for us to ask you to clarify for staff that the correct rule is not partial discontinuance. It is the unitary approach. But that's how I would understand the issue.
Okay. I like that footnote. I wasn't considering discontinuation in that. I was just thinking, like, you know, if you're switching tenants, if they're fungible, like whether they came in like the next week. I wasn't considering in that whether, you know, they came in 2 years later. I think I agree with the way it would shake out. I'm just not sure I could, it's sort of dictating what, you know, the legal result of a contested case would be in the future.
Well, we don't have the ability in this application to ask you to modify the decision in any way that's inconsistent with your original decision. But we believe what we're asking for is a modification that's completely consistent with it for this reason. The first thing that you did was exactly what the Oregon Supreme Court says should be done in these types of non-conforming use vested rights cases, and that is identify what is the lawful use under consideration. And you were clear that the lawful use under consideration was not 60 individual permits. It was this overall functioning park, as the Troutners call it. And by the way, I would agree with your characterization. That's not a legal use description. That is a handy description of what they applied for and what they received approval of. Having identified the use as what Luba calls a unitary use, and a unitary use, as you described, is one of these uses that's operated on an overall basis but has individual units, a hotel with hotel rooms, storefronts in a mall, spaces in a mobile home park. And given that that is the nature of the use that you identify, then it is completely consistent with that, that if there were an issue in the future of one of those buildings being vacant for a year, that the correct analysis is to find that it is reviewed as a unitary use, not as a partial abandonment. That's the reasoning we have for asking you to add that aspect to the opinion. And we think it's completely consistent with the way you analyze the issue to begin with. Let's see, what else can I add here? I guess what I would suggest at this point is we'd ask that you leave the record open for additional submissions, and that you allow us the opportunity for final written argument. And in that, we will articulate as best we can how each of the requests we have made is consistent with, as a modification, is consistent with your original decision, so you can make that determination. That's really our I think, the next step from here. Happy to answer any questions that you have.
Okay. Yeah, so I understand the part about the potential discontinuation. Is there anything else that's occurring right now that the county is not letting you do that you think you should be able to do? I'm just trying to get a grasp of what the problem is.
I'll defer that to Brad, but I do believe currently we're able to proceed. Our concerns are what exactly will the rules be when there are delays in issuance of licenses or delays in getting a tenant into a building or the passage of time between the transition between one tenant and another. Those sorts of operational aspects are our problem. We think that in obtaining a vested right, that we obtain the right to continue the construction and finish it and to operate the business as it was originally approved. And that's essentially the assurance we're looking for.
Yes, Clackamas County and we have been working with them closely ever since the determination, and everything is moving forward. We're making great progress with everything. Again, our greatest concern is once we do have 60 licenses on site, if one of those licenses goes away, if one building remains unlicensed for over a year because we're just waiting on OLCC to do what they need to do, we don't want to lose the right to relicense that building, as Jennifer said we would. And we don't think that's fair, and that's the biggest reason we're here.
Okay. I think Mr. Schaefer had his hand up.
Thank you. Joseph Schaefer, work as a land use planner at Jordan Ramis. The address is 2 Center Point, Lake Oswego, 97035. I would just like to address a comment made by the staff in the initial presentation about what the use was originally approved. And so I'm going to read you a sentence here from the last Type 1 approval. This was Z0215-18-MJ. And it says, this proposal, and I'm on the first page under the proposal section, which is sort of a narrative description of the proposal. It talks about the 30 buildings approved, and this is in the second phase. And then it says, this proposal is a minor modification to the second phase in the Marijuana Agricultural Business Park, known commonly as Troutner Farms. So from our perspective, this whole issue of partial continuance, discontinuance, assumes that there were 60 original land use approvals and that each individual building stands on its own. That's not the history of the Type 1 applications. That was, the first one was for 30, the second one was for 30 more. And we think that really supports a finding that the use is unitary in nature, as opposed to 60 separate, or in the case of the Crosley application in Columbia County, where they had a gun club, but a variety of different buildings with different functions. Okay, all these buildings have the same function, analogous to an apartment building or something like that. So I just want to underline what the original Type 1 approvals were for, and that Troutner's always applied for a business park. And that is what we think the original vesting approval was for. Thank you.
So I'll close there by simply referencing the Oregon Supreme Court's decision in Polk County versus Martin, which is cited in our materials, where the court said the first step in these cases is to identify the nature of the use. And that is what the hearings officer did in the decision. It was not exceeding your authority to do that. That was an absolutely correct analytical step. And in describing the use, you describe what Luba would call a unitary use. And that's why we think it's completely consistent with your decision to specify that in the future, if there is a period of time where a building is not used, that the unitary use analysis applies.
Okay. That sounds almost more like I'm not even sure it's a modification, it's more of a clarification. I suppose I could have something that clarifies that, yeah, this should be, I understood this as the same type of use as like the shopping mall or the mobile home park, that it should be treated that way if there's ever any disputes. I don't think I can say how those disputes end up. I mean, I think even in the mobile home park, if they just left a couple of those spots empty and weren't doing anything to try to fill them for a couple of years, they'd probably lose them. And that would probably apply to you guys too. And again, this is all speculation. This isn't, I can't decide that now, but it seems like they ought to, this use ought to be treated the same way as that use was. And if that's all you guys want, then that might be an easy result.
That clarification.
Sure it. I'm sorry.
I'm just going to say that clarification would be very useful, I think, to all of us, to the applicant and the staff as well.
Okay. All right. And I'll wait to see. We'll have the open record period, so I guess you can clarify that. A lot of the other stuff, though, the 14 things, a lot of them seem sort of prospective, speculative. I couldn't really do. I am sort of curious about, like, from the counties, like, how do we resolve the issue of whether or not, I think especially your first one, where the clock is either already run out or you need the tolling or not, but how the applicant gets a resolution of whether they're getting tolled or not. I don't think this is the way to do it, but there ought to be some way. And that's kind of an interesting issue. I think there was something in Ms. Hughes' letter or email talking about how, well, that initial, the type one approval wasn't appealed, so it's not told. And there's a bunch of case law about, I'm not sure it's the word they use, but I call it sort of entangled decisions that, and I've had some cases in Eugene, sort of a very similar issue where there were two like related applications. One of them got appealed, one didn't. They tried to say, oh, you missed your opportunity because you didn't move forward. And I said, no, they're entangled basically, so you're okay. And this is maybe a little different, so there was an actual appeal, but you do sort of have the same sort of delay. So, I mean, it's an interesting issue. I'm not sure how it would be resolved, but there seems like there needs to be some way to get it resolved. But again, I don't think this is the case for it, but I'd be interested to find out what the actual process for that is. Hope that's not too confusing there. So is there anything else anybody wanted to add? We've just sort of been doing this conversationally since it's just, okay, yeah.
Joseph Schaefer again, just on a technical question for Glenn. Glenn, if you could shoot us the exhibit list, that would help us understand what we may or may not want to submit for the record.
Absolutely. Yep. I'll just send it to all three of you.
Thank you, Glenn.
I saw it. Mr. Trout, were you raising your hand?
Yeah, one last thing. Jennifer made it very clear to us that as long as we show continual progress, we could take 100 years to finish this place. So tolling the clock really isn't a priority for me personally. I know our attorneys are doing their best to protect us in every way possible. But she's made it very clear in writing and email that we could take 100 years or however long it takes, as long as we're showing continual progress. And I guess that means technically and legally that as long as one permit is pulled each and every year, that shows continual progress. So I feel comfortable with that. I just wanted to voice that real quick.
Okay. All right. Well, I think that is everybody who wanted to speak today. Oh, Ms. Dance.
I just wanted to confirm that in doing all the permit issuance, that it has been my understanding that for progress, the vested right determination, the two type one decisions were clear and standard objectives. So they weren't necessarily appealable because they had clear and standard objectives. And to move forward with them, the vested right determination allows them with forward progress every 12 months of any type of building permit application to continue to proceed up until they get fully established. So there's no, the vets' right termination kind of overrides the it administers the two type one decisions, but manages them through the vested right decision.
Oh, so they don't have to worry about losing that approval because they didn't get it done in the 4 years.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, that sort of reaffirms, like, you know, that it seems like this ought to be able to be worked out. So, okay. With that, I think that's every vote, Mr. Hamburg.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'll let you finish.
No. I was going to wrap it up. So if you got something else to say, this would be the time.
Yeah, sure. Just to clarify, Mr. Schaefer described those type one decisions as approving a business park. They did not approve a business park. They were for marijuana production as conducted according to Section 841. So it looked at areas for growing marijuana, the method that marijuana would be grown, whether indoor or outdoor, evaluated whether or not that production met the requirements in 841 and found that it could. Didn't approve a business park or any other specific use. And the modification request that's before us is more than just clarifications of terminology. I mean, to be sure, staff isn't that confused by the decision, at least how it's administered in our office. You know, we are, as I've described, issuing permits, swapping out luxes without non-conforming use alterations already today. We have been since January. What the request is asking for is substantive changes to the application, including a substantive change to the earlier determination that the clock issue cannot be told, a substantive change to now say when buildings can be quote unquote occupied, those kinds of things. So they're not necessarily all about just clarifications, their changes. And the staff report kind of breaks down how the staff feels those either meet the modification criteria or not. And then there was a comment about considering buildings. Again, there may be an issue of the non-conforming status of physical structures in the future. We can't imagine how the laws might change between now and then. So we could not necessarily foresee what might be issues of non-conformity in the future. Somebody just has to make the application and show these are the circumstances, this is what we had lawfully established prior to any new restrictions, and et cetera. That's all that I have to add.
Okay, thank you. Well, with that then, we can close the public hearing. The record will be left open. I've got the county's little spiel for that, so. Mr. Ramis, is one week fine with you?
Yes, I'm fine.
Okay. Ms. Chamberg, does that work for you too?
It would. I'll just note that the 150-day clock on this application is October 2nd. So I don't know if the week's breakdown would require an extension of the decision clock. October 2nd is 150 days from when.
Yeah, we would be happy to extend the clock to whatever time period the hearings officer felt reasonable.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay. So one week, it works for everybody. Great. So the record is open 1 week from today for any participant to submit additional written evidence, argument, or testimony. The record is open an additional 1 week after that for any participant to respond to new evidence submitted during the first open record period. And finally, the record is open an additional 1 week after that for the applicant to submit their final written argument in support of the application. And that final submittal shall not include any new evidence. Again, it needs to be in by 4 p.m. on the due date to the county. I think with that, we can conclude today's proceedings. So thank you, everybody.
All right. My thanks to the hearings officer and the staff as well. Appreciate it.
Thank you all. Take care.
And thanks for the technical work here, actually making this happen, which I know is not easy.
Darcy should be, you don't know the miracles that she pulls off behind the scenes.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah, this has been unusually smooth.
Yeah.
And well organized. So thank you for that.
Thanks, Darcy.
All right, enjoy your day, everybody. I'll email those exhibits and the exhibit list.
All right, thank you, Matt.
Great. Bye, everybody.